Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
Mr. Singh, your response first, please, to the federal government's announcement, Afghan interpreters for the Canadian Armed Forces and other Afghan nationals who worked with and served with Canadians and served Canada's interests during the NATO mission in Afghanistan will be brought to this country. What are your thoughts?
That's right. I think we absolutely did. And I think that's one of the things that makes us a special place that we can do that. And to be able to provide that opportunity for folks to get support and to be able to leave a place where there's a lot of troubling news and serious risk to people is a good thing.
Yeah. The sexual misconduct issue in the CAF is dragging along with Mr. Trudeau insisting he knew nothing of the 2018 encounter between then CAF Ombudsman Gary Wellborn and the Minister of National Defence, Arjit Sajjan. Do you believe Mr. Trudeau? And what is your reaction to reports on Global News that Mr. Sajjan told the military to create a position eventually filled by a reserve officer from his old unit who had been suspended from the Vancouver police for an inappropriate relationship with a subordinate? This is according to briefing notes. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that this has been a colossal mess for the Liberals. They and the Conservatives, frankly, both are where are the problems in the military. This is well known that there were problems, and there was a Deschamps report, which is starting to feel a lot like deja vu. This is a Supreme Court justice from the Supreme Court of Canada who does a report into the problems in the military and finds primary recommendation that there is no way for people to raise complaints, to raise problems, other than going to their superior officer. And that is a massive problem. If you look around the world, no other military or many other militaries have an alternative mean, which is an independent process. That was Justice Deschamps' number one recommendation. And to this date, 6 years later, Trudeau has not done that. It is squarely at the feet of Prime Minister Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, that he could have put in place that instead of actually dealing with the problem, this culture that is dangerous to women and a complete lack of independent process forward. What we have is another report by another justice of the Superior Court. And now the justice of the Superior Court has incredible experience and is going to do a great job. But why have another report when you have not implemented the first? And what message does this all this send to women? The fact that if a woman brings up a problem and it makes it to the highest office of the land, and instead of anything happening, they're fighting over who knew what when. That is a shame, and it sends a chilling message, not to just women in the military, but to all women, that they can raise concerns and no one's going to listen to them.
So let's talk about a broad concern that is raised in this country, and you raise it on a regular basis. You have this week particularly. Would you speak to the issue of racism in Canada, individual and systemic racism? Where do you see racism engaged and by whom?
Well, there is systemic racism that people experience, and we see it in the treatment, in particular recently the rise in anti-Asian hate. There have been lots of stories. I have a constituent from Burnaby South. Her mom goes for walks. She's of Asian descent. And she called her mom. She shared this with me and told her, "Mom, I don't think you should be taking your evening walks anymore." With the increase in violence against Asian women in particular, we're seeing Muslim women who are being faced with violence, their hijab being torn off. And in London, the killing, the massacre really of an entire family in Ottawa or in Quebec City, again, a targeted killing of Muslims while they were praying. There's clearly a problem of hate on the rise, and there's clearly a systemic problem where we see in policing services or in security services that the real and urgent threat to Canadians' lives are coming from white supremacist groups or extreme right-wing groups that are sowing these messages of division, are radicalizing people. And they are not really receiving any scrutiny. They're not being dismantled. They're not receiving the attention that is required. And we're seeing disproportionate stopping of people that are racialized just because of the color of their skin. Indigenous people continue to be mistreated by police. So these are ongoing and real issues. And sometimes while we are better than other nations in some ways, I think the problem with Canadians is we're sometimes too polite to accept and confront the realities of the challenges that we're up against. And I think one of the positive things, though, is that Canada is up to the challenge, and I feel like people want things to be better, and we can make things better.
What do you mean when you say the ultra-rich must pay their fair share in taxes? Now, I get the soundbite, Mr. Singh, but beyond the soundbite, what are you proposing specifically?
Well, a host of measures. Really, the principle is, when we look at this pandemic, a lot of people are wondering who's going to pay for the pandemic and who's going to pay for the recovery. And it's a legitimate question, because after difficult times, we've seen two approaches have been really the go-to game plan for previous federal governments, liberal or conservative. Either there is a period of austerity where services and help that people need is cut, or the burden is increased on the people that have actually already suffered, workers and middle class and small businesses then see an increase in their taxes. I'm proposing a third option. That's to say, we know that people, large wealthy corporations, make money off the backs of Canadians, take that money, all profits made in Canada off of Canadians, and hide it in offshore bank accounts, and it's completely legal to do so. We want to end those loopholes and take on those that are hiding their wealth and not paying their fair share. You know, everyday workers pay their fair share, but the ultra rich get away with not doing that. So when I mean ultra rich, people who use offshore bank accounts to hide their wealth, those are people I'm talking about. I'm also talking about Amazon, a company that made record profits in this pandemic, but virtually pays no taxes in Canada. That should not be allowed to continue. And Canadians are frustrated. I'm hearing a lot of people saying, you know, we've seen the billionaires go to space and enjoy all this massive wealth. The richest Canadian billionaires, 44 of them, increased their wealth by $70 billion in this pandemic. They should be contributing their fair share. And their fair share means not having loopholes that allow them to hide their wealth. That means making sure they contribute fairly. And we've got a host of ways to do that.
So let me bring this down to the street level. You're also calling for an immediate increase of the minimum wage federally. Do you think that after coming out of the pandemic, and we're not out yet, with the CFIB telling us repeatedly up to 250,000 small businesses are in danger of not surviving, that increasing the minimum wage should be extended to all businesses, including small businesses? And if so, how is that sustainable for people who've told me they were keeping employees on the payroll by using up their own and personal credit lines? Are you looking at extending the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage for the small business community in this country?
Well, what we're doing is that we want to set the leadership by saying that at the federal level, we can impose or we can put in place a federally regulated minimum wage. And we think that it should be a decent wage. And we want to set an example with that. But with the small business example that you raised, I think it's really important to highlight that in this pandemic, big box stores were able to continue to operate, did all right. But it's really small businesses that were hardest hit. So we laid out a plan saying for small businesses, specifically for those that qualify as small business, we want to see the supports like the wage subsidy and the rent subsidy continue for those small businesses so they can continue to have the help they need. And the way we pay for that is, again, to make sure the large corporations, the wealthy Amazons and Netflix and Googles and companies that hide their wealth in offshore tax havens, they contribute their fair share, and we invest that into helping those who need support the most. So I would continue, it's a part of our jobs plan, I would continue supports for small businesses past the end point that the Liberals have proposed, and to help those that need it most, these small businesses that have suffered a lot during the pandemic.
Would you be in favor then of larger federal deficits and not necessarily to be too concerned about spiraling national debt?
Well, I understand the concern, and the concern is people start wondering, well, if this debt and deficit continue, who's going to pay for it? And that's why I answered that question by saying we do need to continue investing in people. We can't cut those investments. So if we're not going to cut the investments, and we certainly don't believe in increasing the burden on people who've already suffered, that's why we're proposing this third option. There's significant revenue that the Parliamentary Budget Office has pointed out with our plan of taxing the ultra rich. There's lots of revenue that we can raise. We can use that to invest more in people and to pay down our deficit or pay down our debt.
Yeah, Mr. Singh, the residential schools issue it is very difficult to accept that Canada had a policy of residential schools until 1996. And I've twice recently spoken with Chief Cadmus DeLorme of Cowessess First Nation on this program, as well as with Jody Wilson-Raybould, whose departure from Parliament you tweeted you're sad to see. How do you, Mr. Singh, approach the issue of reconciliation, keeping the residential schools issue in mind? What do you do?
It's heartbreaking. And I think it really hit Canadians with the first discovery, the 215 in Kamloops. It really rocked a lot of Canadian sensibility because it was a way to be confronted with the real painful reality of residential schools in a way that I don't think a lot of Canadians ever had confronted before. We were having some conversations about this. I thought about the grade schools that I went to in Windsor, Ontario, and the thought that there would be a grave site on my elementary school. You know, no Canadian that has gone to a major city elementary school has a gravesite on their actual elementary school's school site. It's really an example of what these institutions really were. They were institutions that were a part of the genocide of Indigenous people. There's no other way to put it, and it's something that is painful. But the beautiful in this really horrible moment is that Canadians are starting to demand for justice. They're saying we can't just grieve and mourn the loss. We have to do something about it. And that to me is really hopeful that Canadians want to see justice. So what do? We need to make sure that every child is brought back home. Every single child that lost his or her life in a residential institution has to be able to be brought back home. Every community should have the ability to investigate any burial sites. Those communities need supports for the trauma. I've spoken to people that are still reeling from the trauma. It's reopened a lot of wounds. Survivors, and many of them that you mentioned, 1996 wasn't that long ago. There's a lot of survivors, and they think about those that didn't make it home and those that they thought maybe ran away, and maybe instead of running away, they actually lost their lives. So we've got to deal with the trauma. There's calls to action, 94 of them. The Liberal government promised to implement them. They've only done a fraction. We need to implement all those calls to action.
Okay, so why you instead of Justin Trudeau? You're gaining on him as far as popularity polls are concerned, but why you instead of Justin Trudeau? And do you believe Mr. Trudeau has difficulty telling the truth to Canadians about his own and his government's actions? For example, do you believe Mr. Trudeau has been truthful about SNC-Lavalin and Jody Wilson-Raybould? Do you believe he's been truthful about his and his government's actions involving We Charity?
Very heavy question. I think very important question. I'll start with the why me. I would say I have in my life experienced a lot of the struggles that Canadians continue to experience. I remember what it's like to struggle in life. I've had to struggle. I remember what it's like to deal with financial difficulty. There was a time when my father, who was a very successful physician, was dealing with a struggle with addiction. It meant that we lost everything. He lost his savings. We lost our home. And we didn't have a place to live for a bit. I remember being a young man, the eldest in my family, having to provide for my family, care for my brother when I was in university and get him into high school and support him through schooling. While my friends were having a fun university lifestyle, I was kind of the surrogate father of a young teenage boy, and I had to step up and provide that support. There was a time where I was the only income supporter of my family, and as a young lawyer, I was the one paying all the bills at 26, 27, supporting a household of my mom and my dad and my brother.
Yeah, so clearly your life was not a parallel to Mr. Trudeau's.
Right.
But let's get to this issue of Mr. Trudeau being truthful with Canadians. Again, SNC-Lavalin, Jody Wilson-Raybould, the We Charity. Do you believe that he's being truthful, or do you think he's being less than truthful?
I believe what he has shown is a pattern of behavior where he helps out his close friends and very powerful at the top. And so in each of those examples, SNC-Lavalin, a corporation that in the past had been linked to illegal donations to the Liberal Party, and the We Charity, close friends that he helped out. But the big problem is each one of those incidents in helping out these companies, he hurts people. With We Charity, it was supposed to be about helping students and young people. He ended up hurting them because there's no help that was delivered. At the end of the day, that was $1 billion that was supposed to be invested.
In the interest of time, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but in the interest of time,
no problem.
Is he being truthful with Canadians, yes or no?
I think that he is choosing the ultra-rich and the wealthy over Canadians. I think he's not telling the full story, but it's not just about not telling the full story. It's about who he's choosing when he votes against things, when he votes against taxing the ultra-rich or votes against PharmaCare or supports We Charity. These are all examples of helping the powerful and hurting people.
Okay, so he's not telling the truth. Mr. Singh, what about you differentiating yourself from Erin O'Toole?
Well, interesting examples. Each of those things that I mentioned in the taxing the ultra rich, which I think a lot of Canadians agree with, it was when we put that motion forward, it was Justin Trudeau and Erin O'Toole, Liberals and Conservatives, who teamed up to vote against that. When we said we should get rid of for-profit, starting with Revera, which is owned by a federal agency and should be public, it should be about care for our loved ones, not about profit. It was Erin O'Toole and Justin Trudeau that voted against getting profit out of long-term care. When we said that PharmaCare example I gave you and something that Canadians believe makes a lot of sense, it was again Erin O'Toole and Justin Trudeau that teamed up to vote against PharmaCare. So on a lot of these really important things to Canadians, taxing the rich, medication coverage for all, and long-term care that cares for our loved ones, Mr. Trudeau and Mr. O'Toole both took the side of the for-profit long-term care, the pharmaceutical companies, and the ultra-rich against people. And so we can make a clear distinction. Our focus is always on people.
All right. Climate change. Do you support additional carbon taxes?
I support a price on pollution that actually tax or puts the price or puts the burden on the biggest polluters. The price on pollution that Mr. Trudeau has implemented actually exempts some of the biggest polluters. And I think that's a big problem. We need to take on the biggest polluters. We need to protect our land, air, and water. We've seen forest fires ravaging BC. I've, in my home riding of Burnaby South, there have been massive heat waves, the likes of which we've never seen. People lost their life because they're not used to these type of temperatures in the lower mainland of BC. So we know the impact of these forest fires right now in Toronto. We're here, we're still a couple of days past, we're having smoke in the city because of the forest fires in Northern Ontario. These are directly caused by climate crisis, and we've got to take it on. And the way to do that is not to put the burden on families that are struggling, but to put the burden on the biggest polluters.
Alberta Justice Minister Casey Madu is calling on Ottawa to allow individual people to carry pepper spray in order to defend themselves against premeditated racist and other attacks. At present, defending yourself with pepper spray is an offence under Canada's criminal code. And I keep saying, and I know it's going to irritate some people, but it's a play on words, because pepper spray is an irritant. It's not a 44 Magnum. Minister, how are you? Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you so much, Roy, for having me.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Would you share what caused you to take the decision to seek an amending of the criminal code to permit the carrying of pepper spray by individuals?
You know, Roy, we have seen an increase in hate-motivated crimes against mostly vulnerable Albertans. And we, at the provincial level, have doing everything we can to make sure that we protect vulnerable Albertans. For example, Roy, we have put in place the Alberta Security Infrastructure Program that would grant $100,000 to help cultural minority communities protect their facilities. We have established the Alberta Hate Crime Coordination Unit. We have appointed a hate crime liaison officer. We are doing everything within our jurisdiction as a province. There are other things that are required that lies in the hands of the federal government, and that includes my call to Justin Trudeau to work with us to amend the criminal code to allow for individuals who are vulnerable to these attacks to carry pepper spray, as well as to implement mandatory minimum sentences.
Yeah. Minister, I understand that people who are vulnerable to attacks motivated by hate need to have the right to protect themselves, and pepper spray is one of those first defense tools that can, I keep using the word irritant because that what it is, that can so irritate the breathing and the eyes of an attacker that they break off the attack. It's also a tool that is possible, that is useful to other vulnerable people, to women and to older Canadians who might be seen as a target of opportunity.
Absolutely. Roy, the Albertans want action. Canadians want action. Mm-hmm. We have taken action at the federal level. At the provincial level. I want Justin Trudeau to take action at the federal level. You know, I have always heard them say they are committed to protecting Canadians, protecting vulnerable Canadians. Here is a classical example for them to take action. You know, Roy, talk is cheap. Talk is easy. You know, we are tired of the virtual signaling coming from the federal government. Now it is time for them to take action. This is a common sense proposal. As rightly said, it is an irritant. It would help vulnerable women ward off the attackers.
What are you expecting, Minister, from the Prime Minister of Canada? Have you heard back from either the Prime Minister or the Federal Justice Minister?
To be blunt, Roy, this federal government led by Justin Trudeau is not listening to Albertans. My hope is that they follow through on their professed commitment to protect Canadians, their professed commitment to protect minority cultural communities. We have seen increases in attacks against those groups. This is a common sense proposal that would help those communities, and indeed any Canadian, any Albertan who feels threatened by these attacks. I am not losing my breath, but you know, I am going on the commitment that I have heard from the federal government that they are serious about combating hate-motivated crimes, and this is one of the ways to accomplish that.
Minister Madhu, what options do you have as a provincial justice minister and solicitor general?
Roy, my option is to continue to implement policies, programs, put forward bills that are within the provincial jurisdiction. And when it comes to pepper spray and mandatory minimum sentences, those are criminal code provisions that require amendment to the criminal code. That is a federal matter.
Yeah. Now, police chiefs in the province of Alberta have expressed some concerns. Tell us about that, please.
You know, Roy, it is disappointing to hear from the police chiefs in our province expressing concern. And let me add, it is not all of the police chiefs. I have heard it from individual police chiefs. I understand they have an association expressing concern. I understand they want to sit down with me. I am prepared to sit down with them. But at the end of the day, they also have an interest in making sure that we protect these Albertans and these Canadians. I have asked them, what more do we need to do beyond what we have done so far? And so far, they have not been able to put forward anything beyond what we have done so far. So my hope is that they would work with us to see the benefit of amending the criminal code to allow for pepper spray. There are obviously parameters that we have to put in place to ensure that this is not misused. In any case, our criminal justice system is well capable to deal with those who would attempt to misuse the pepper spray if one would put it in place.
Yeah, you know, currently, as you well know, Minister, currently, a person using pepper spray as a defensive tool to save his or herself from injury or possible death can, under the Criminal Code of Canada, spend more time in prison than the attacker.
Roy, it is ridiculous. Why should someone who is being attacked, who has not taken a life-saving step to protect and to preserve themselves from harm or from death, be the one to go to prison rather than the attacker? I would prefer the attacker to be sprayed than to send it to threaten an innocent citizen who's been attacked from going to prison. This is one of those ridiculous provisions that we have in the criminal code that I think the time has come to get rid of it.
Yeah, and it's not a hypothetical situation, Minister, again, as you well know, because I've spoken on the air with Canadians who were criminally charged after defending themselves from home invaders, and these Canadians included a 69-year-old man who defended himself against three home invaders in eastern Canada and in the Atlantic provinces, and he was facing years in prison while his attackers faced far less time. So he's defending himself and his life after being attacked inside his home, and he's the one who's facing this more serious criminal charges. The whole system has to be looked at, but you're not looking at that situation. You're looking at making pepper spray legal. Minister, it just sounds terribly reasonable to me.
It absolutely reasonable, and that is also what I'm hearing from across rural Alberta. they are facing home invasion attacks upon attacks. And if you recall, Roy, that was the reason why we made changes to the Occupiers Liability Act in Alberta to prevent rural Albertans who are taking steps to protect themselves, their families, and their property from criminal and civil liability. I think the time has come for us to do the same thing with the criminal code.
Major General Dean Milner was the last commanding officer in Kandahar, or at least in Afghanistan, for the Canadian Forces. And we've been talking to General Milner over the last number of weeks as he and two of his colleagues wrote an open letter to the federal immigration minister calling for the repatriation of the interpreters to this country. General Milner, thank you so much for coming back on the program. And what can you share with us, please, about what you know about the effort that's underway to extricate the Afghan interpreters and their families?
Well, first of all, Roy, it's good to talk to you, and it is good news. I think it's very encouraging. Obviously, we've heard from the immigration minister that we are planning to bring those that worked alongside the Canadians that volunteered and worked alongside of us in difficult situations against the Taliban. So this is very encouraging. I know that there's planning teams working feverishly both on the ground back here in Canada, and obviously with a situation that they know that they need to get this going fast. And I think the challenge will be now is the devil in the details of locating the interpreters, making sure that we've got the right ones, and then moving them to a location where we can then extricate them.
General, can you share with us a little bit of an idea of the danger these individuals and their families are in? Because I imagine they're going to have to, many of them will have to go from where they happen to be in hiding in Afghanistan at the present time to some sort of central location area, maybe Kabul, where they'll be dealt with as far as getting them out of the country and into Canada is concerned. What danger are they in right now?
Well, absolute danger. The Taliban have a number of checkpoints in and around some of the major cities. As you know, they've taken a large number of the districts. So the Taliban are in large numbers. So, we're not on the ground. So there's absolutely going to be a challenge. We have been able to move some people around. We still have some good connections with the Afghan army. And so we've been able to help some, but they're going to have to maneuver. I know quite a few of them have already moved into places where that we can help them, and we'll be prepared to take them and their families out. But again, the situation's extremely difficult, and there's going to be risk for some for sure to move themselves to where we're going to take them out from.
This is probably a question that you're not going to be able to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I have to. Is there a chance, is there likelihood that the Canadian military is going to be necessary in this operation some way, perhaps some of our special operators?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are options for sure. They'll look at a number of different options and to take them out, it could be commercial, it could be military, we could charter, but there will need to be a capable force on the ground that prepares and takes them in. They'll do some initial medical vetting and confirmation of who they are. We'll need a very good team on the ground. A couple of the major cities where we'll be doing most of the work are very secure. We get that from, obviously, personnel that are on the ground. This will be a very capable force required to conduct this operation.
And that might include Joint Task Force 2?
Oh, I don't want to jump out and say that, Roy, but if I was a betting man, I would say that yes. I mean, we always send our most capable, highly trained, it's hard to beat them. I mean, they've got experiences around the world. They absolutely could be part of that security force that goes in with the other teams that are required to be there. So I would say, if I was a betting man, yes.
Okay, General Milner, what would you consider to be the greatest logistical, perhaps other challenge, to extricating the Afghans from the dangers they face at this particular time? What's the greatest logistical challenge?
Well, I wouldn't call it a logistic. I think it's going to be a challenge for the some of these Afghan interpreters. They're across the country, and as we well know, the country's not as safe as it was months and months ago. So, you know, I mean, them and their families, we're not on the ground. The Americans are not on the ground. They're in the ground around their embassy. I think they've still got about 1,000 on the ground. Countries are not out in the districts and the provinces. So, you know, these poor interpreters are going to have to take risk, and they're going to have to move. Logistically speaking, you know, it's a matter of us lining up the capabilities, the aircraft. I don't think that's a problem at all. We easily have. We train for these kind of operations. So logistically, I think it won't be difficult at all.
Major Campbell, thank you very much for coming on the program. How are you feeling about what the government announced yesterday?
Well, I'm pretty pleased, Roy. I mean, it's positive news. It's a positive direction. Canada Last is sort of, you know, the government sat on its hands for quite a long time on this one, given the urgency of the situation. But it's good to see that we finally got some forward movement.
You've been in contact with your friend, Major General Habibi, who was on this program with you a couple of weeks ago. What are you hearing from the general?
He's pleased, but as I told the general, you know, let's not celebrate until you're here in Canada, because there are many hurdles yet to be surmounted before we actually get their feet on the ground here in safety. So, you know, he's cautiously pleased or cautiously optimistic, I guess. You know, I've been very, very careful all along the way not to make any promises to General Habibi that I couldn't keep. Because, you know, I mean, maybe the government wasn't going to step up. We didn't know. And so I've been very cautious in my dealings with him, being supportive for sure, but also being cautious about making promises that I couldn't keep.
Yeah. Major Campbell, we talk a lot about the interpreters, and appropriately so. And they still, in many cases, are going to have to make their way to Kabul, which is going to be a dangerous journey for them, depending on where they are, because that's where the sort of the central location is for getting them out of the country and into Canada. But talk to us, please, for a moment about the importance of the Afghan National Army commanders and the troops that you worked with and how they interacted with Canadian forces.
Oh, well, I mean, they were absolutely essential to the operation, to the mission. We tried to put an Afghan face on every operation that we did, because after all, it was their country and their security situation that they had to come to terms with. So, I mean, working with them as I did on a, you know, daily basis, I mean, I virtually lived with the Afghans that I was mentoring, and did everything but pray with them. You know, ate meals with them, lived with them, operated with them, chatted with them, spent time with them. I mean, yeah, we were brothers in arms, and I mean, their support to our operations was incredible. And you know, they would follow us into combat or lead us into combat, no questions asked. And I mean, you can't, allies like that, you can't just leave behind. I mean, it's you got to look to the future. Who's going to work with us if we don't take care of the people that worked with us in the last time? You know what I mean? So this was of national importance.
Yeah, it is, because as you say, there will be a next time. And if we don't bring with us a record of taking care of those who work with us and providing them with some security and safety, then who will want to work with us? What do you think of the fact that the U.S. is now the last NATO nation that's pulling out? They're almost entirely out of Afghanistan now. That's got to be depressing for many who fought there. It's got to be tough on you.
Yeah, it's, you know, you have your moment for sure. As a veteran of Afghanistan, I think we've all had to come to terms with the fact that you know, what we did was we bought time for the Afghans and 20 years of time. So that was time for a six-year-old girl to become a 26-year-old woman, you know, capable of deciding her own destiny. So we gave the Afghans time. We gave them resources. We gave them training. We bought them some what we hoped was some breathing space in order to come to terms with their future without a war going on in the background.
Okay.
And I think we bought them that time. We did what the government asked of us. We did everything that was asked of us and more. And we did provide the Afghans with that breathing space. Was it long enough? Well, that's for the historians to decide. But we gave the Afghans an opportunity, and what they chose to do with it was entirely up to them. It always was. It's their country, their future, their destiny.
Major Campbell, thank you very much for the time today. Thanks for all the time you spent with us and for what you've done and you do for this country. Thank you, sir.
You're very welcome, Roy. I think you make more out of it than it is, but I'm certainly pleased that we are where we are with this program moving forward for the interpreters and our allies that worked with us overseas. I mean, this is a very positive development, and we just need to keep going with it. Canada needs to fulfill its moral obligation to take care of these people.
Yes, sir. My good friend Joe Warmington, columnist with the Toronto Sun, the Sun Papers, was the driving force behind letting all of us in this country know about what was going on with the interpreters. I didn't know until I read Joe's column 5 years ago. And I saw a tweet from my colleague and friend Charles Adler yesterday, and Charles said the same thing, that knowing about Joe and reading Joe's column got Charles started, and Charles done great work for the interpreters. But Joe really led it all, and Joe, thank you for informing all of us of what the dangers were that were facing the interpreters, because you are the catalyst in getting this thing finally, hopefully, under some sort of resolution.
Well, you know what? It's nice of you to say. I mean, you're right. It takes everybody to do their part. I think the big key now, Roy, is General Milner, General Fraser, and Thompson, who are really pushing this. They all, you know, were commanders in Afghanistan, and particularly General Milner, I know, is going to be on the show again. He was the final commander there. You know, this all started for me in 2011 when I went to Afghanistan, and I had an interpreter. His name was Ahmed, and he saved our life, you know, not to over-dramatize, you know, that we were in any major battles or anything like that. We were just moving around the country, all over the country, but many, many times he said, don't go down this road, don't go down that road, don't go in this building. He just had this instinct, and he also had connections. I'd like to find him and get him to Canada. He worked with the Canadians. I can't find him. I don't know what that means. They tried to kill him before, the Taliban. They burned his house down, and so I'm worried about that. But that's where it started for me, and then along came James Acam, who's been on your show many times. And he's in Canada now, and that was the kind of the fruits of our work 5 years ago. I know you and I and Charles Adler and many others felt that James would be the first to get off the airplane in Canada, and there'd be many, many more. And, of course, nothing happened. And here we are 5 years later, thankfully, and we're just so close to getting dozens of people out of there. If we don't do it, they're going to die there.
Yeah, no question. They are going to die, and they'll die horribly. And General Milner has said that on this show, and he's going to be with us later on today.
I admire him so much. You know, I admire General Milner and General Frey, all of the generals. But, you know, General Fraser, you think about Operation Medusa. General Milner, you think about the training, the Afghan army, which are really holding tough there, too. We can't help everybody there, but our prayers to them as well, because they were our partners. We helped train them. And, you know, it's not just the interpreters, and I think that's something good that Minister Mendocino said yesterday. I was very, very pleased with his statement. And, you know, talking about the people that served with the Canadians, not just the interpreters, but people that worked on the bases or people that we trained that are Afghan nationals. So this is going to be a big operation. I don't know how it's going to go. Our prayers are with everybody involved with it.
Yeah. It was General Milner who told us 2 weeks ago, I think, Joe, 2 or 3 weeks ago, he said the Canadian veterans who went out into battle with the Afghan interpreters going with them, unarmed, often the first target for the Taliban or the insurgents, because they knew if they could kill the interpreter, they would take a vital link away from the Canadians to be able to communicate with village elders and to understand the customs and the traditions of the area. General Milner said that the veterans, the CAF veterans from Afghanistan, consider these interpreters to be comrades in arms. They're not just somebody who went out with them and worked for them. They are comrades in arms.
And you can't have anybody more trusted than in this field of battle. I mean, it's the most, you know, stark and nasty place in the world that I've ever been to. I mean, it changed my life. And I was just there for 8 nights. Imagine these people living there, growing up there, or all our brave troops. You know, for the 158 and a diplomat, 59, that died right along the Highway of Heroes. I mean, we owe it to all of them to make sure that if we're not going to stay, you know, and help save that country, there's all kinds of geopolitical things and reasons for that, but at least we can get these people that serve with us that put their lives on the line. You know, something else you said about the customs and the different things, well, that's all important. I talked about the lay of the land, you know, logistics, and just the look on someone's face about turning down a road. They knew all that stuff. They weren't just translators. They were really key logistics people. General Miller knows that. General Fraser sure knows that, and I know it too. And, you know, it's the right thing to do. It would be wrong. Blood would be on our hands. I don't blame, I think there's a lot of, you know, people that blame politicians and all that stuff. I think they're trying their best, and I think we need to encourage them to do that.
No, they're finally trying their best, Joe.
Yeah,
well, they're finally doing what Canadians tell them to do.
I have plenty of thoughts on the five-year wait, and even the five-year wait before that, because I was working on this since I got back in 2011, and it was Corporal Eric Kirkwood, who was on your show back then. He's the one that brought James McCown to my attention, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Tony White is who I was in Afghanistan with, and he introduced me to this issue there. And so I've been working on this with other people for over 10 years. So, yeah, this is, I'm on pins and needles about it.
Yeah. Joe, tell us a little bit about your time in Afghanistan. What are the sorts of things that you saw? What are the sorts of things you were told? What came back with you?
Well, I think, you know, I talked to a little bit with Charles Adler about this, too. The one thing was the three little girls that were walking down the street. I was in this armored car, and we were flying by really quickly, and I captured this image with my camera of three, you know, I don't know, they were maybe 6 or 7 years old. They're running away to school. They had the school bags that were handed out by NATO. And it just, I mean, everybody loved the picture. I mean, I still look at it all the time because it represented something, you know, obviously for why we lost all our men and women there. And you know, the opportunity for people. So that was one of the things. And then I think, you know, after everywhere I went, there was 22 people killed in the 8 nights I was there in around where I was. And that wasn't a really big death week for Afghanistan, but for me it was. And we went by roadside bombings and we saw buildings bombed. And then after everywhere I went to, the Serena Hotel and Sufi restaurant and different places where I met people, all those things were later bombed and shot up. You probably remember some of those stories. The Serena Hotel, certainly, where there was journalists killed and there was all kinds of Afghan nationals killed by the Taliban and by the other group that was in there. So I think that was the thing. And I also feel really strongly that if you're going to break something, then you own it. And I feel that, you know, this is a bigger story for another time, Roy, but I just don't understand NATO, Americans, Canadians, British, New Zealand, everybody walking away from these people. I don't understand that. How can we do that to them? You know, if it means 50 years, that's what it means. I mean, we kind of gave them a promise and we're breaking it.
You know, it's interesting you say this because Major General Jeffrey Schlosser, who was the commanding officer of the 101st Airborne Division in the U.S. military, that storied division that has fought in just every battle really, since actually probably before World War II, he's going to be on this program a little later today. He has a book called Marathon War, Leadership in Combat in Afghanistan, and that's one of the things that he talks about, leaving at a time like this. And if I understand the general correctly, he is not at all in favor of having pulled out as Biden is doing now, or as the other NATO countries have done, including
us. No, it's really disgusting to do it because there's going to be a lot of bloodshed. But the world's done this before. We did it in Vietnam.
That's
true. And we've done in other places. And you think about Europe after World War II. I know it's a different scenario, but you know, we stayed there for different reasons. But the fact that NATO was there for 50 years after the war made a big difference. And I think that you've got to make a 50-year commitment. And, you know, yes, it costs money and it costs all our great troops and things like that. But if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right. They've done it wrong. And that's why we're scrambling now to get these interpreters and the support staff out, because they're going to pay the price for that. And I have a column on TorontoSun.com, and we almost pulled it down because the guy I wrote about is in hiding right now in Afghanistan. He served with our troops, and I won't say where he served and where he is, but he was worried, you know. He wanted to do the story. We did the story, and we're sticking with it, but he's taking a hell of a risk, Roy. You know, we talked about, did we want me to take the story down, and we decided for the bigger picture. He decided. I let him decide to keep it up. But this shows you the risk. I'm not worried about the Taliban getting me, and you're not worried about them getting you, but he knows that they'll get him. We had an interpreter that was killed this week, and as you said at the top of the show, you played that clip. That's real. They will behead people. They will kill them, you know, and they are the enemy, and they are an evil enemy, and they are lethal, and they have control. I don't know what the number is. I keep reading 80%. I don't think it's that much, but I think within 6 months, you know, the way things are looking with the Americans pulling out, I think it's very likely that the Taliban will control most of Afghanistan. And I'm sick at heart about it.
Yeah, and that's what General Schlosser says as well. It's going to be a replay of what we've already experienced.
Well, we're gonna pay for it later.
That's exactly the point he makes, Joe. That's exactly the point he makes. You're right. You're right.
Vaccines, masks, all this stuff we're talking about now. Wait till the Taliban get control again. The next 10 years are going to be ugly, and then we're going to have to deal with it again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I covered 9/11. I was on the air with you from New York. And all these things, every time I talk to you, I think, well, hey, I talked to Roy about this or Roy about that, and we're right back to where we started.
That's right. We are. Joe, thank you for everything you do, and thanks for coming on today. But we owe you, this country owes you a debt of gratitude for reminding us of our obligations.
Well, nice of you to say. I'm a cheerleader here. You know, I don't want to upset anybody in any government. Just get it done. Get those people out of there and their families.
Global News headline today, Liberal majority government in doubt as lead over conservatives shrinks. Poll finds. Well, the poll is by Ipsos Public Affairs, and Daryl Bricker is the president and CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. He joins us on the Roy Green Show. Daryl is also the author of the book that I keep insisting every Canadian family should have and each Canadian should read, needs to read, must read. The book is next. It's what's going to happen in this country going forward. And since you're likely going to be around for it, you need to read next. Daryl, good to have you with us. What's going on?
Well, what we're seeing is a race people keep talking about getting started is tightening up. So since our last poll a couple of weeks ago, the lead between the Liberals had over the Conservatives has shrunk by half. So they've gone from 12 to a 6-point advantage. So that suggests that, you know, we're going to get into an election campaign, and the likelihood is that things are going to even tighten up further.
So I guess the fundamental journalistic question is why?
Well, I think the reason is because what's happening is that where the government gets its highest grades is for its management of the pandemic. And as people are starting to feel that the pandemic is getting into our rearview mirror, they're starting to move off of what was the most important issue back onto the issues that were the most urgent issue back onto the issues that they perceived previously as the most important. And things like the economy, affordability, those kinds of things. And quite frankly, the government doesn't score that well on many of those issues. Other opposition parties are seen as preferable on some of them. So what happens is that the race tightens up as people focus on those other issues.
So we have the Liberals now at 36 points, the Conservatives at 30, the NDP at 20, which leaves the Bloc in Quebec as a significant player in that province. And from the Global News story and from your research, if the Liberals are going to try to recover from this downward turn, they're going to have to look at three provinces particularly, Ontario, Quebec, and British Columbia, correct?
Correct. So let's go through each of them, Roy.
Sure.
So in Quebec, What's happened is that the Liberals are in a fairly tight race. I think they've got about a 5 or 6 point lead over the Bloc Québécois. That's frankly, that's not enough, because what that shows is the Liberals are probably doing a little bit better in seats that they already have. So they need to expand that lead if they're going to generate any more seats. And the reason for this election is they're having this election is to get a majority. So they need more seats. You get to Ontario, the Liberals have about an 8 point lead over the Conservatives. They were much further ahead than that in the last election campaign. It was double digits. And particularly in the 905, which is where they won the election campaign. We haven't split out the 416 and the 905 in this poll, but when it's as close as 8, it tells me that it's fairly close to tied in the 905. That's a problem for the Liberals. And then when we go to British Columbia, the Liberal Party is in second place and the Conservative Party is in first place. That's the only other place where there's a significant number of seats that they can win. And right now they're trailing the Conservative Party and look unlikely to pick up seats in British Columbia.
So is Justin Trudeau the problem for the Liberals?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's Justin Trudeau himself, but it's also the issues agenda that the public is confronting. And so when they look at things like, for example, the economy, back in in 2015, when Justin Trudeau won his majority government, he had a double-digit lead over the Conservatives on the economy. Right now, he trails the Conservatives by 8 on the economy. That's not good.
No.
On affordability and cost of living, he trails the NDP. Healthcare, which tends to be a nonpartisan issue, and by the way, the most significant issue Canadians tell us, is pretty much a nonpartisan issue in the sense that nobody really thinks that any of the parties can do a great job, but the Liberals have a bit of an advantage. This election will not be about healthcare. And then that leads us into things like climate change, where the Liberals have staked out a pretty big claim, but the Green Party, in spite of all of the disruption that we're hearing about, continues to lead on that issue. So the problem that they've got is the issues that they would really need to dominate in the campaign, and they were probably counting on, like management of the COVID crisis, are going into the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm. Is there let me back this up. In 2019, the Liberals won government with the lowest popular vote percentage in the history of this country for a winning party federally.
Right.
So if there is a low voter turnout in 2021, is there an opportunity for an O'Toole minority government?
Well, that's where it starts to get very interesting, Roy. Very interesting indeed. Because the reason that the Liberals have did well in 2015 and then did well again in 2019 is that turnout was at historically high levels in the modern era. Stephen Harper won his majority when turnout was at its lowest, very lowest. It was about 59. In the last two election campaigns, it was about 68. So the Liberals have been able to communicate to the Canadians, particularly progressive Canadians, that the election had consequence and that they needed to get behind them in order to stop the Conservative Party. At the moment, the public doesn't believe the Conservative Party is going to win. They don't particularly see them as a threat. And what that means is that the usual Liberal strategy of marginalizing the NDP by scaring progressive scaring progressive voters about the potential for a Conservative government, that's not really a strong strategy at the moment. If that happens, turnout is low. The Conservative base is high. They're more likely to show up and vote, they tell us. Anything can happen.
And this is not, as you say, Canada is not about a national vote. It's regional voting that decides.
Yeah, it's a series of regional campaigns. So the thing that I'll be watching over the next little while is, do we see any movement in Quebec? Are the Liberals able to get back into double-digit territory in the province of Ontario? And are they able to move into first place in British Columbia? If they can't do those three things, very difficult for them to win a majority.
Well, I can't wait for the goodie package to arrive.
Well, you know, it's on the way, Roy. We'll be doing lots of polling for Global through the election campaign. We'll be able to share all of these insights with your listeners and everybody who interacts with Global News over the space of the next few weeks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.